Tonight we turn our attention in the Protestant, in our version of the Ten Commandments, to number 9 and number 10. Thou shalt not bear false witness, or lie, as it's sometimes translated, and thou shalt not covet, which then opens up to all of the things that one is not to covet. These are, I think, interesting commandments because arguably they're the most common, and probably they are the two things that we experience the earliest. One does not have to teach a child to covet. They just have to see a kid who has something they want. And one does not have to teach a toddler to lie. Just ask them how something got broken, and they'll come up with an answer. And it's not a temptation. It's simply these things are a little bit more inherent in our experience. I think, you know, when it comes to thou shalt not murder and adultery and some of those big things, we think, oh yeah, these are natural to us. In some ways, these are kind of the gateway sins or the gateway commandments. They show up early in the human story. And we will make the case in both of these that they're bigger than the words. That's kind of the approach we've taken through this study. Essentially, the pattern we will use is that, yes, truth is honesty, but it's far bigger than that. I think you might be surprised at some of the things our ancestors put under this commandment. And then, of course, covet is to want what isn't yours, but there's a little more to that as well. So we're going to get started here. We'll go into the 9th commandment, do not bear false witness. The word there for witness is essentially a wrong answer. And the word for false is to deceit or to deceive or to injure. So again, this is more than just tell the truth. This is saying things that detract from another, that harm another, that do damage. And so, again, as we go through this, you might be surprised. This is one of those, this is going to sting a little bit, probably, for most of us.
So the form on this is pretty simple. You can all hear me, right? The form on this is pretty simple. We're going to be looking through both these commandments, what Westminster does with them, because it really flushes both of them out pretty well. So the we'll start with the things that we know. When you hear, do not bear false witness, I assume that we're all largely on this page. Westminster says, speaking untruth, lying, slandering, backbiting, detracting, talebearing, and whispering. And my favorite in there is talebearing, because that happens about once a week in the Gwecki house. I get a tale of what the other sister did, and then it's all a detective story to figure out what actually happened, right? Which is some amalgamation of both. We know that. We would assume that when we hear do not bear false witness, we know we are supposed to say things that corroborate with the truth, with what actually happened, with fact. But then Westminster is going to keep going. So I grouped these into two categories. The first is false witness as it relates to neighbor on that horizontal plane, and then false witness as it applies to God on the vertical plane. So we'll start with neighbor because we had to pick a place to start. So first is prejudicing the truth and the good name of our neighbors as well as our own, especially in public judicature. So in other words, basically all of the conversation that happens in every House of Representatives meeting that happens in D.C. Basically, any time that you use words that discredit or that speak negative to the name of another person, that you're bearing false witness against them. And so the idea is, especially in public, we should be careful about what we say. Passing unjust sentence, calling evil good and good evil, rewarding the wicked according to the work of the righteous, and the righteous according to the work of the wicked. So the idea would be that if you have a person charged of a crime and that they didn't commit it and they are found guilty of it, you're breaking the commandment of false witness. That actually, even though it's done in a court of law and it maybe followed the order of that, it still violates the spirit of the commandment because it's not for the, it's not based in truth. It's not based in the interest of the person. And to treat a person who is righteous or to correlate a righteous person with wicked things is also a form of bearing false witness, which is interesting. We might think of the commandment going the other way, that we know that wicked people shouldn't be treated as if they're righteous, that that bears false witness to their character. But so the same the other way, Westminster says.
We move on. Evil suspicion, speaking, grieving, or envying the deserved credit of another, speaking to impair it. So when we see someone get an award, win a basketball game, win a football game, and we begin to say they didn't deserve it, they this, they that, they shouldn't do it, they shouldn't, that wasn't fair, this didn't count. That is, according to Westminster, to give false witness. Then we have scoffing, reviling, rash, harsh remarks, censuring with words and actions. So this is negativity, scoffing and reviling. So-and-so is a jerk, an idiot, fool, fill in the blank, right? I don't know if you all pay attention. There's this thing called social media. It lives here. I am both astounded and hurts my soul, the character of humans, when you see some post and someone put up their new puppy and someone else says, that puppy looks stupid. I hate your shoes. There is this movement in our culture that just revels in vomiting negative stuff into the world. And it happens everywhere, but it is so observable in our social media to scoff and revile. And interestingly enough, our people, our creed writers, our Presbyterian mothers and fathers said that is commandment breaking. That is a false witness. Now, may it be true that you hate their shoes or that their dog is ugly? Maybe. But it is a false witness to God. It is to falsely live as people who are called to be better. And I think I don't want to get on this soapbox because I'm going to climb back on it here in a little bit, but I think we're struggling with that in the moment that we're in.
I won't take it much further than that, but I do want to add, you do realize that in the online space, we actually had to create a word for that negativity. It's called trolling. I don't know if you know that. So trolling are people who actually will put up their hand and say, I like chasing after people to say mean things about them. They would probably use four-letter words, but I'm not going to do that. But the people who say, no, this is the thing that I do. And I think to the point here, we struggle as Christians because if you come to these commandments and these commandments for you as a Christian are kind of best practices that you try to do a little bit, that then generally you'll feel bad when you're on whatever and you say a thing and you think later, oh, maybe that wasn't the nicest thing to say. It's an entirely another thing if you come to these commandments and say, no, I believe that this is God's best plan for the world, that I'm called to live in such a way that this becomes part of my character. I do think that this has significant implications for what Christians think about how we engage in virtual and online spaces. I realize this is kind of the wrong room to engage with some of that at the cultural level, But I just want to put, as far as you have kids or grandkids or you're having those conversations, like my our daughters are living up in, are growing up in a world where they will always, as long as they consider themselves Christian, they will always also be living in a world in which they take for granted these virtual encounters with other people. So helping them to understand what a Christian character and ethic in that world looks like is essential. We have to take that seriously as we're seeking to live into the truth of these commandments. Moving forward, the Westminster goes on, whenever we rejoice in others' disgrace and infamy, when we have scornful contempt or fond admiration, breach of lawful promises, forgery, and concealing the truth, the idea that whenever we celebrate someone else's misfortune, whenever we celebrate someone else's lack of character, that is a kind of false witness we should avoid. Giving false evidence or giving false witnesses, wittingly appearing and pleading for an evil cause, outfacing and overbearing the truth, which is, I think, also speaking to a really important sort of movement in our modern society. There's a real substantial conversation about who should I trust? Who can I trust that what they're saying is accurate and not simply self-seeking or self-serving? And this commandment speaks directly to that. And I do think specifically within the church, not pointing this at culture, pointing at this within the church, I do think that we continue to strive to hit that bar, to tell the truth. But oftentimes we've gotten waylaid by things that seemed like the most important thing to say as truth, when later we realized, oh, we should have been focusing on these other things. I'll give you an example. For some traditions, the idea of moral ethic, you know, do not dance, don't roll dice, right? Whatever that thing is. And then over here, their kid grows up and they've never read the Bible. They focus so much on the don'ts that they never gave their child an opportunity to learn the who is Jesus and Joseph and Moses. And, you know, Presbyterians, this is a little bit of a soapbox for me, but ultimately, we being people of the book, we have room to grow there as well, knowing what's in it and knowing the constructive positive of what God calls us to do. So the commandment, it tells us stay away from these places where we are going to be giving into or standing behind things for self-seeking purposes as opposed to seeking the truth unto itself. I guess I'll close this out. This is maybe the hardest hitting in this section. Speaking the truth unseasonably or maliciously to a wrong end, which, think about what that means. What you say might be true, but if it's intended or lands for the purpose of hurting or destroying another person, you saying the thing that was truthful still bears false witness against the other person because it does harm to them, which that's a pretty powerful standard. That's a pretty high standard to hit.
Yeah, when you swing truth as if it's a club, you may be accurate, but Westminster would question whether you're right. You may be right about a thing, but if you use truth to attack a person, again, you're using it falsely. It's not the thing that you're saying that's false. It's the motivation. It's what's behind it. And again, I think it's interesting that our people in this commandment have this duality, this twofold idea that our speaking and our witness is both outward facing and inward facing. So we are to be people of internal truth, but we are to be people of a not false or a true witness to the outsider. We are to be committed to know and live by truth, and yet we are to treat truth properly in its context with other people. And this is one that I think we struggle with. I think Christians struggle with this. I think there is a segment of the church that doesn't know exactly what to do with truth. Just finished listening to a podcast about a very large church that kind of came apart. And if you go back, there were several things that got covered up. Pastors doing things that clearly are out of bounds, and people in the church saying, well, but if we expose that, if we talk about that, then it'll hurt the church. And so this idea of covering the truth. On the other hand, there are pastors who have gotten hold of truth. Jane's older sister lives in Texas, my sister-in-law, Sue. They were up for vacation one time. They'd moved to Texas. It'd been a while, but at some point they were looking for churches. And she said, Clint, can I ask you a question? Sure. So we visited this church, and during church, the pastor pointed out a couple that was getting a divorce because the husband was unrepentant and wouldn't go to therapy, wouldn't do what he was supposed to do, and had an affair. And the pastor is just telling everybody this during church. Is that normal? I'm like, no, Sue, there's nothing normal about that. And so, again, is the pastor saying what's true? Probably. Is that the way and the place to say it? Definitely not. So this is more than about being right. This is how we handle truth. And I think, I wish, I'll save that. Go ahead.
Okay. So then I'll dig a different one. Moving on. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the vertical sense of this. And I did kind of save what for me hit me pretty hard, or maybe hardest here on this. So this we'll talk about false witness before God. Westminster says, undue silence in a just cause is false witness, so that holding our peace when inequity calls for either reproof from ourselves or complaint to others. Think about what that means in more modern speak. In other words, if you fail to speak in a situation in which truth should be brought to bear, either against yourself or against another, you've committed false witness, which is a very, very high bar. The idea is not just what's said, but that thing which is withheld from being said. And certainly, I know I've been in a situation before where I've made the wrong call in that. Then the idea of flattering or boasting in an excessive way, thinking too highly or also thinking too lowly of ourselves. Ultimately, the idea is, are you assessing things as they actually are? And that's the thing that over the years I've tried to get better at. But you know when someone has come up to you, you're a Midwesterner, you're a Presbyterian, they come up to you, they said, you did that thing really well. They're just trying to offer you a compliment. And there's that thing within you that says, no, I'm actually horrible. You don't even know, right? You're trying to deflect back a compliment to be humble, right? But the reformers are going to make the case, there's no need for you to have false humility. Accept that with gratitude, accept it with humility, and move on. Don't say something that's not true. If you worked hard at woodworking and you made a beautiful piece of art out of wood, it doesn't help to say, I'm not a woodworker, right? It does help to say, thanks be to God, I really appreciate that comment. And I think that Westminster would point us in that direction. And that what's included in that is recognizing the gift that God has given you. So one of the sins they name is when we deny the gifts of God, that's bearing false witness to what God has done in our life. And then, you know, I think that this is pretty simple for most of us. Also, bearing false witness is when we hide or we make excuses for our sins. When we're called to confess what's true about ourselves and we fail to do so, or we decide to not do so. And that ultimately, we either do that for ourselves or we do for another. When you see someone in the position of leadership do something that is clearly not reflective of the character of a person who's following God, it would be therefore a sin to say, well, they're doing that for this reason. I mean, ultimately, if that action is not in truth, then it should be named as such. And I think that's what I've got.
So I think, again, I think we live, we're not unique. People have always struggled, society, culture, we've always had stuff, right? But I do think we live in a very interesting time to ask the question, what is truth? Is truth what people believe? Is truth what people pass on the internet? Is truth some shadowy thing that only we know about? It is a fascinating moment to think about what it means to be people who not only can be trusted to seek what's true, but can be trusted to handle it well, gracefully, graciously, who can be called to speak up when necessary, but also who can be trusted to bite back words that don't need to be said. That, as you all know, that is brutally difficult. To say the right thing at the right time, in the right way, for the right reason, is monstrously hard. It's easy to vent. It's easy to criticize. It's easy to gossip. It's easy to do those things. It's easy to stay silent and not get engaged when something is wrong. It's easy to be jealous and speak down of others. Those things are simple, and they're exampled for us constantly. And so what does it mean to be people who bear true witness, which is the opposite of the commandment, right? If we're called not to bear false witness, what does it mean to bear true witness? What does it mean to tell the truth, which is so much bigger than, you know, not lying? Not lying is, that's a great place to start. We should all start there. But we have to go far beyond that. And I think the church is in a moment of question in terms of how do we engage a conversation about truth in the broader context. I think the church has either been silent in that debate or has been sidelined in that debate. And I hope for the church's sake that we will find a reasonable and faithful way into the conversation, because I think moving forward, certainly as a church and also as a people, a commitment to truthfulness and a commitment to true witness is significantly important. I think that it's something we're going to have to continue to work on and strive toward.
I'll be completely frank with you. Some of that is keeping our own house in order. And I think I'll just quick tell you a story that this has been pretty heavy on me. I was going to look up a thing, so I had to log on to Facebook, and you know how Facebook like targets your brain with the top thing that you, I know you're going to click on this when you load into Facebook, right? And so there it was. It was a post from this pastor's group. I want to be clear. It's like under 40 Presbyterian pastors on Facebook in the Presbyterian Church USA, okay? And it was this post, and I was like, oh, hey, look, eye candy. And I clicked on the thing, okay? And it was, I didn't make it to the bottom because I kind of, I felt soul sick. But it was, there was a post of a person who had said a thing that this group of pastors found reprehensible. And it was just verbal dogpiling for miles. And I just thought, as I kept going, and I was waiting for, by the way, I didn't say anything in that conversation, which means I probably committed a sin. So this is complicated. I'm not, there's no knight in shining armor here. I want to make that clear. But as you go down, what struck me is all of these people who have done the education, all of these people are clearly committed to the task of doing work in the name of Jesus. And all of these people sound exactly like the world in which we live, which is that kind of attack, attack, attack. And not just doing so on the, it had not only the smack of ideology, I think that I'm right, he had the smack of glorying in another person being dumb or another person, you know. And I think so that's sort of a higher level view, Jim. Should have I spoken into that context? Maybe. Would that be a context in which that word could be heard? I don't know. And once again, I don't know. Maybe that's the problem, is entering in with the courage to tell the truth in that, or what you see to be truth. I honestly wrestled with this, so I don't want to pretend like there's a simple answer. But I will say, as it goes down the ladder, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with all people is not an unimportant command, right? So as far as it depends on you, when you get head targeted by Facebook because you load up the app and it puts the top thing for you, what are you going to do with that? And when you go into your household within the four walls of where you live, how are you going to treat whatever people you find there? And then when you come to worship on Sunday and we inevitably brush up against each other and realize, oh, wow, you think substantially different on that thing, how will you respond to that person? I don't have an answer. I want to be clear about that. But I do think that we have to, as Christians, take these commands seriously enough to try to pursue them ourselves. Because I don't know, I'll be honest with you, the world's problem seems so big, I don't know how you show up and try to address that. I just think if you can address the greenhouse in which you live, that seems to be the spirit of the command as I see it.
Yeah, I mean, I join you there, Jan. I think many of us do. The idea that it's hard to even have a reasonable conversation because one person says things are better and the other person says, no, they're not, they're worse. And you say, well, but crime did this. No, it did this. And we can't even agree on the parameters of a real discussion, which makes it nearly impossible to have an honest kind of debate. I think from a personal standpoint, that our motivation is to not participate, you know, possibly to model a better way, if we can do that. I'm not sure you move that needle much on a Facebook discussion, but when you're talking to people, to try and be more positive, certainly. And it's, I do think it's work. I think right now our cultural current sweeps us toward negativity. And I think to row against that or swim against that, it does take consistent and conscious effort. I really do. I mean, there are probably some people who are just naturally positive and it you know, doesn't phase them. I don't think that's many of us. I think most of us feel that pull and think, oh, I wish it wasn't this way, which is, you know, so then I think mostly it becomes a matter of, if we all can make a small difference, maybe we can move the needle a little bit as a whole. I'm not sure. Hopefully. And, you know, let's be honest. News stations, media outlets, they do that because it works. Because if they get you mad, yeah, you know. So if they can offend you or get you upset, they keep your attention. No. I mean, things are going great is not a very, it's just not a very marketable message. So, anything else? What else regards to false witness? Okay. Then we move on to the last commandment, again, in our take on the commandments, do not covet your neighbor's wife, your neighbor's house, neighbor's donkey or servant. You know, you get into it, it just means don't covet. It'd be nice, maybe we should shorten it, but interestingly, the word covet means desire, and it's a word you might know in the early chapters of Genesis when Eve sees the tree and finds it appealing, desirable. That's this word. So when later on, when Exodus says don't covet, it means don't desire what you're not to have or what isn't yours or what is wrong. And again, I find if you've watched young children, this one, this is so natural to us. You don't have to be taught to covet. Now, Having said that, I do think we live in a culture that thrives on coveting. Coveting is great business practice. If we can convince people they need what they don't have, and they need what their neighbors have, and they need to get ahead of what their neighbors have, we can sell a lot of stuff. And our culture is not above those tricks. Advertising is great at that stuff. From the time that you start listening to radios, watching television, or reading magazines, people who spend a lot of time thinking about how to do it have tried to sell you things, right? That there's a whole industry based on how can we get people to buy our stuff. It's very hard to come along in that culture and say, don't covet, don't want things you don't need, right? Yeah, sure. But I think this is one that is pretty natural to us, to want what we don't have, to want what others have, and at our very worst, to not want others to have what we don't. So not only to want to take, but to want to keep from them, to want to remove from them. I think coveting gets, for a commandment that seems pretty innocuous, I think this one gets close to our worst pretty quickly. I think there's some ugliness in there that this commandment can uncover.
Growing up, I used to watch the TV channel TLC all the time, but that was before all the reality TV stuff. They actually just showed documentaries and stuff back then, you know, the real nerd stuff. And there was a whole series of shows that I loved. There was like all of these crazy wealthy whatevers. I remember one of them was, is the store named Barron's in London? Is that the name of a highbrow store? I think there was a really uppity, swanky store in downtown London, either way. And I remember the whole purpose of this show was to show they had a Monopoly board where all the pieces were diamonds, real diamonds. And they had a video game console that was made out of gold, and you could buy this. It was all this extravagant stuff. It was like, hey, today, hey, you want to see Michael Jordan's 10,000 square foot house? Here's pictures of it. And you know, people do this all the time. The temptation is not just to want that for yourself, to think that that's what this commandment is speaking towards. It's also to say that you don't want that other person not to have it. That's a tough transition to make, right? To say, okay, I'm fine. I get that I don't have Monopoly with diamond pieces, but you shouldn't get to have Monopoly with diamond pieces. Right? You put on your pants the same way that I do every day. Why do you get Monopoly? Right? I think the crazy thing is that when you frame the commandments from a theological view, meaning when you put them in relationship to God, then it becomes not a thing about is something slightly equivalent. Well, is your Monopoly board about as equivalent? I don't know how I got locked onto that. It's not about, is yours a little bit better than mine? And am I okay with that? It's God has given you these things and you're a steward of them. God has given that person these things and made them a steward of that. It's none of your business what God has given. That's the frame. It's to say when you put this in relationship with God, that this is outside of your pay grade, literally. That the creator of the universe has bestowed this good gift on them. Who are you to wish evil on them for that fact? And simultaneously, who are you to despise the gift that God has given you, though you consider it less? That is to despise what God has given you and made you steward of. And that's where the theological note, I think, is actually different. This isn't some kind of like, just try to be happy and positive when you don't have the stuff that you want to have. That's a very cultural conversation. When you say, the creator of the universe bestows good gifts on those that God loves, then who are we to wish evil on those who've been given good gifts and to miss the good gifts that God has given in our life? Which makes the covet command, I think, it gives it a lot of teeth.
Yeah, though let's be clear, nobody should have a diamond Monopoly set. It's not a thing that should exist.
May the record reflect, I tried to move away from that illustration.
So when we desire right? This is the idea that there's a temptation there. When we see someone else happy and it makes us less happy. When we see someone else who has something that we don't and it makes us less appreciative of what we have, it steals our gratitude. When we believe that if we had the next thing, we would be happier. We would be more fulfilled. I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong. I mean, we are so blessed to live beyond a culture in which you were born into a niche and you had no choice but to stay there. We live in an incredible place where literally in one generation, a person can change their entire social status. They can grow up poor and end up doing well, right? And that's an incredible blessing. And there is something to be said for the kind of discontent and restlessness that moves us forward in life and motivates us and makes us better. But when we begin to live life outside of ourselves and through the eyes of what others have, we become dangerously tempted to minimize the blessings we have had. And to begin to covet, to want to take from or lessen other people. And that's the danger. And again, that sounds, oh, sure, like kids on the playground, jealousy stuff, right? I like your shoes. Why did Cain kill Abel? Because he was jealous, right? The first sin, jealous, coveted. Abel got a good word from God that Cain didn't get. And it did something. It broke him. So then he lies. Let's go out in the field. And then he murders. But it starts with this seed of coveting. And coveting takes us to most of the sins on up the ladder. Adultery starts with coveting. I wish I was happier. I wish I was this. I wish he did that or she did that. Murder. I wish I had that. Stealing. I want that. Right? Coveting, it seems so small. It seems so innocent. But it is a minefield. And I think we don't always know what to do with it because, again, we live in a kind of forward-looking and upward-looking culture. And there's tremendous blessing in that. I want to be clear. I don't think that in and of itself is sinful. It is something that has to be hemmed in. It is something you have to be very careful with. The sins forbidden, if we can go to Westminster for a minute, discontent with our own estate, envying and grieving at the good of our neighbor, and motions and affections to anything that belongs to our neighbor, right? So it is this pathway that gets paved for us that's born of jealousy, that's born of dissatisfaction, and the places it leads are dangerous. What does anybody remember what God tells Cain when he's upset? Oh, come on, folks. This is like the third page of the Bible. He tells him, sin is lurking at your door, but you must master it, right? Sin is right there. It wants to take you. It wants to show you where to go, and you have to tell it no. That's the danger of coveting, is that it lurks and that it whispers and that it says, oh, just go a little further down that road. And the places it leads us to are dangerous. And, you know, again, I don't know. It's not a word we use very often. We probably use jealousy more often, but it is dangerous. And so, interestingly, Westminster says the least about coveting of any of the other sins, and part of that I think is because it's the most specific. And part of that, I think, is it's also the most self-explanatory. There's not as much to flush out in this one, I think, as some of the others. So it may not sound like it has much to offer modern people, but I would argue that it's pretty important if we rightly understand it. The sort of concluding thoughts, if we want to try and finalize this, is, and we said this in the opening session, right? The relationship between law and grace. And how do Christians view the idea of something like commandments, of laws? You know, Paul is very adamant in the book of Romans and other places that we are no longer people of law. We're people of grace. We're not saved by law. We're not bound by law. We're not held under law. We are people of grace. And yet, Paul is just as insistent that the law offers us something. The law offers us a path. If you remember correctly, we said early on in this session, this series, that John Calvin talked about the law as a picture of the redeemed life. In other words, when we read the commandments, we see what Christian life looks like. A life trying to turn from idols. A life trying to keep God first. A life avoiding anger and negativity and coveting and false witness. It is a map for us. And we do the commandments a disservice when we think they're just a yes or no checklist. The commandments are a map to what a Christ-like life looks like. And they shouldn't be distilled into just morals or ethical principles, because when they do that, we lose something. Now, is it fine that a courthouse wants to put them up? Sure. Is it okay that some schools say we should put them on the walls? Yeah, it's fine. The danger in that, though, is we can't think that when they read them, they know what we know about them. They are not secular. The commandments belong to us. They are God's gift to His people. They're not good advice for schools and grocery stores and banks and courthouses. They are covenant behaviors for covenant people. Is it good that other people see them and live by them? Yeah, sure, that's great. Is that good for society? Yeah, it has some upsides. But they don't know what they mean. And the church can't just turn them over as if they are the checklist that everyone has to follow, because we are the ones who should properly understand that more than laws, these are the invitation to the life that we are offered in Christ. And so I think when we hear those conversations about what is the place of the law, what are the place of the Ten Commandments, I'm not offended by those commandments, but I do think the reminder is appropriate. These are ours. We best know what they mean. We've spent a couple thousands of years thinking them over. In the case of the Ten Commandments, several thousand years with the Jews before Christians. And we should be careful, I believe, not to divorce them from their Christian or their spiritual context. And I think that's important.
So one way to look at that is that Christ transforms the commandment from one thing into another. And the image that comes to mind, how many of you remember the original Wizard of Oz movie? That movie starts, and you remember how literally black and white it is, right? How drab it is, and the movie goes forward and forward. And you know how your eye, like any black and white television, you get used to it. It's just fine. It doesn't get in the way of your enjoying the thing that you're watching. But then suddenly there comes that point in the movie where they just flip the switch and here's the color. You remember what that feels like? That moment where everything's transformed? That's the difference between the commandments without Christ and then the commandments after Christ. Jesus Christ transforms the commandments. Everything is different. It becomes color. All of the motivations, all of the reasonings, all of the life of the commandments is just bursting with energy because of who He is. And yes, in some ways, he makes it much, much more difficult to follow the commandments. When he says, I tell you, it's not just don't commit adultery. It's don't look at a woman with lust. Jesus just knocked out the entire American culture because we literally have billboards that are built to sell with lust. So, I mean, at the end of the day, we have to be aware that when we falsely make the commandments just good moralisms, just good ideas that we hope everybody picks up, that we're not giving them the key to it. We have to give them Jesus. And if we give them Jesus, and if we show them Jesus in the way that we live and the way that we speak, then ultimately the commandments will be given a kind of color and life that they would never have without. And I just think there's nothing wrong with wanting people in our world to be moral. That's a good goal. We should shoot for that, for a just society. But all the same, as Christians come to the commandment, and this is our covenantal understanding of what it means to be people of God, I think that rooted relationship transforms how we consider what force these commandments have in our life. And maybe just a really quick example of that. Clint and I were both talking about this ahead of time. We both in college ran up against this philosophical question. Today, one of the commandments was do not bear false witness, right? Don't lie. And we both in undergrad had people ask us, me, it was a professor, I don't know who it was in Clint's context, but it was, if you have Jews that you're hiding in your basement and the Nazis knock on your door, do you have to tell them that there are Jews in your basement? Do you have to tell them the truth? Or can you lie? Well, there was debate about that, though I don't think from a Christian perspective, it's debatable. You lie as convincingly as you can. Why would you be allowed to break the commandment? Because the spirit of the commandment is the furtherance of life. The spirit of the commandment is for the sake of the other to be given a whole and safe life, which, by the way, is also part of the do not murder commandment, right? So when you have Christ, the one who gave himself for us, and we see the commandments circle around him, it transforms the law from this legalist structure that you have to interpret rightly or wrongly on the letter, and it becomes a spirit of your character and life. And that's what makes these commandments unique. And I'll be honest, just as like a personal reflection here at the end, what struck me in this study of the commandments, the arc of it, was number one, how often our conscience does lead us in the right direction. How often we do know the right path. And if we would only be honest, if I would only be honest with myself in those moments and be quicker to confess where I got off, all the more I would feel enriched and comforted by these commandments instead of feeling like they are standing over and judging. They do. Paul says that. We stand judged by the commandment. We stand under them, unable to keep them. But if we are quick to admit where we fail, quick to return to the relationship with Jesus Christ that's at the center of it all, I think these commandments have an entirely different life and force. And it struck me in our time together.
Yeah. So again, we hope there's something that's been helpful in this. I think it comes down to how you understand the commandments. You know, on a good day, on a general day for me, I'm not going to make a graven image. I'm pretty unlikely to murder someone. I'm not going to commit adultery. I'm not a good liar. I'm probably not going to lie. So I'm going to bat 500 just on an average day. If we're going by the letter of the law, we start adding lust, anger, false witness. I'm going to get beaten down by those commandments every day. And that's not a bad thing, because then they're pointing me and compelling me and pushing me towards something better. And so, again, I hope that there's been a surprise for you in a way to see the commandments as an invitation to discipleship and not as a judge that's passing sentence over us. I really appreciate our heritage and our perspective that says, yes, the commandments are laws, but for the Christian, they're also a picture of the life that we are called and invited to live. And I think if there's one takeaway for you in this series, I hope it's that. I hope that these aren't just outdated cultural codes, that there's something more. These are a description. These are a picture of what following Jesus looks like. And understood that way, I think they can be far more helpful than you might assume otherwise. So thank you for participating in this. This is always a wonderful thing that we do. Thank you for your generosity in providing food. Thanks for your patience in the study. And we're grateful